This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Aftershocks continue to shake the U.S.-Mexico border after yesterday's 7.2 earthquake on the Baja Peninsula. The trembler caused at least two deaths and dozens of injuries in Mexicali and across the border in Calexico and rattled residents as far away as Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas. Scientists estimate that as many as 20 million people may have felt this powerful quake, and it's just the latest in a string of powerful earthquakes to hit the Western Hemisphere in recent months after Haiti and Chile. There have also been big quakes recently in Turkey and Taiwan. After each, many asks, are these quakes related? And if so, how? If you have questions about that, give us a call and call with your story. If you felt the quake, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, NPR's Mike Pesca on the final four and tonight's NCAA championship game in the men's tournament. But first, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joins us here in Studio 3A. And Richard, always nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be back.
And what do we know about this particular quake?
Well, as you say, it was a magnitude 7.2 in an area that is very prone to earthquakes over the years, of course. It is right along that the same place where the San Andreas runs. It wasn't necessarily directly on the San Andreas Fault, probably not, but it's the same sort of fault zone where you have the Pacific Plate moving north and the relative to the plate that we're sitting on, the North American plate, and earthquakes happen here a lot just because it's one plate's moving relative to the other by about 2 inches a year. So eventually something gives, and that's an earthquake.
7.2, that's big.
That is big. Those kinds of earthquakes do hit dozens of times around the world, and we notice them in particular when they're close to us, and this is clearly an example of that.
But the amount of damage, Haiti, a 7.1, this is clearly on a different scale.
It is a different scale, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Of course, we always hear about building codes and the fact that Haiti was built with really very poor materials and essentially no competence essentially in how it was built. It was sort of just thrown up with brick blocks and so on, and that was a formula for disaster. But the other really important feature of this quake is it was not nearly as close to huge population areas as Haiti's was. I went back and I looked at some of the statistics. The USGS has a program called Pager, which takes a look at how much earth-shaking there is in a particular area, and it's a scale called the modified Mercalli scale that goes from 1 to 10, essentially, and 10 is 10 or 10 plus is as bad as it can possibly shaking. Now, in Haiti, there were more than 2 million people in the 9 Mercalli scale, modified Mercalli scale, more than 2 million people that close to that much violent earth-shaking. In the quake we had yesterday, there were essentially nobody, maybe a couple hundred people in that 9 zone. Most people got considerably less earth shaking. So it was a combination of being just far enough away from the quake to be less violently shaken, and also, by and large, people with better buildings. But still a lot of building damage down there. So it's not, we shouldn't just say, oh, everything stood up. That's not true either.
And again, is there any connection between, there just seem to be a lot of them.
There do seem to be a lot of them. This comes up all the time, and it came up after the Chilean earthquake, and I talked to a bunch of people about that, and statistically it doesn't seem as though there's really a lot of evidence that one big quake then triggers other ones, but there are some realistic scenarios by which you can get quakes triggering distant quakes, and one hypothesis is that the giant Sumatra quake of 2004, which caused
the terrible
tsunami. It was a huge quake, much bigger than these quakes that are that we've been experiencing here. It's some possibility that those reverberations shifted the ground enough around the world that basically it sort of nudged a couple of faults that were a little bit close to failure, making them a little bit more close to failure. So absolutely no proven cause effect relationship with these things, but it's a reasonable hypothesis, and scientists are poking around seeing if they can build up evidence for that, because seismic waves do travel the world, particularly for very large earthquakes, and they do shake things. And of course, earthquakes happen when ground that's been locked for a long time slips. So every little nudge can sort of move you closer to an earthquake.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Daryl, who's on the line from Scottsdale.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes, I was sitting on my computer at about 3:40 yesterday afternoon, and all of a sudden it felt real reminiscent. I'm from Central California, and I was up in the Bay Area during the San Francisco quake in 89, and there it was. It was just kind of a rolling north to south thing. As far as I see it, though, living all over the West Coast, I don't see how anything cannot be related. When at the 89 quake, there was one in China that followed immediately that I think, if I remember right, killed 50,000. How are they not related?
Well, I think there was much more time difference between those two earthquakes, as I recall, from the
Loma Prieta,
from the Loma Prieta quake and the Chinese quake. There was a long period of time. So
it was just a couple of days, wasn't it?
No, I think it was longer than that. But we can check that.
Yeah, I think there was one within hours that was similar. That's worth checking for.
Well, that Google machine will get that in motion and see if we can get any magnitude quakes from that. But thanks very much for relating your experience, Darryl.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. This was Scottsdale's a long way away from Baja California.
That's true. And these seismic waves were focused towards the northwest. Earthquakes actually do tend to, when the fault ruptures, the focus goes in one direction or the other. In the case of Haiti, the people, at least in the city of Port-au-Prince, were fortunate that as bad as that earthquake was, their seismic waves were actually focused away from the city. It, of course, caused huge damage in the areas where it was focused. But this is a quake in the Mexico quake. The waves were focused to the north-northwest, so it's not so surprising that an earthquake of this magnitude could be felt over very long distances.
Let's see if we go next to Pam, and Pam's on the line from Youngstown, Ohio.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I've been wondering for a while if this swarm of earthquakes, including the one in the Midwest, could possibly be related to the calving of the glaciers at the poles and setting up a kind of tectonic instability that we've never seen before.
That's an interesting question. What happens and does happen over long periods of geologic time, we're still coming out of our last ice age. And as the ice melts from that, there is something called isostatic rebound, I think is the technical term. But basically, as the ice melts, the ground rises. And so there is always shifting ground and gravity fields and so on as a result of that. So I think that may have some influence over plate tectonics in the long scheme of things. Certainly what's happening around the poles right now in terms of melting ice is probably not of that scale at all. Let's recall that the melting of the ice in the Arctic is mostly floating sea ice that melts and refreezes every year. So that's not making a huge change to the structure of the Earth. And in Antarctica, the melting is not so significant that you'd expect to see that kind of effect. But clearly, melting ice does affect literally the shape of the Earth. And so that's a reasonable question to ask.
And just to a question about Pam's characterization, is this fair to call it a swarm of earthquakes?
I think that a seismologist would avoid using the phrase swarm, but certainly it's a series of earthquakes that has attracted our attention and has certainly have done a lot of damage.
Pam, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to, this is Teresa. Teresa with us from Portland.
Hey, guys. I was wondering if you could look up something. There's a website called spaceweather.com, and every earthquake that's been happening, I've been looking up just to see about the sunspots, and it seems like the last four major earthquakes, I'm talking at least over 6 point whatever, there has been at least two sunspots on the sun. And I was just wondering if there was correlation through that. And also, if you go to the archive section, you can also check and see if there, in fact, were two or three sunspots during those times.
That's, of course, I can't look at it up right now, but what I can tell you is that the sun is in a relatively quiet phase for its sunspots, and it certainly was during the tsunami earthquake of 2004. The sun's been actually abnormally quiet. So I would be skeptical of a correlation between solar activity and earthquakes. And besides, then you'd have to come up with some sort of brilliant explanation for how sunspots could do that. And sunspots can clearly affect our atmosphere and sort of the radiation environment in which the Earth swims. But in terms of affecting the Earth, that's beyond me to figure out. But it's a very intriguing idea. And if somebody could come up with a mechanism, I think that would be a cool thing to think about.
Teresa.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. After the Chilean earthquake, which was much more powerful than this one, there was some talk about the shifting of the Earth's axis to the point, and the spin of the Earth might be altered to the point where it may have changed the calculation of the length of the day.
Yes, by a tiny, tiny fraction. And I think that does happen after big earthquakes. In fact, the Earth's spin axis is always sort of wobbling around somewhat. It's called the Chandler wobble. And earthquakes around the world do nudge that in imperceptible ways all the time. And so it in the calculation says yes, indeed, it happened. And the and if you say, can you actually go out and see it? The answer is no. It's
too small to measure.
But yeah, the Earth is not a is not just this finely spinning, perfectly calm globe that we think of, you know, as we, you know, idealize it from space. It's the thing's alive in some sense.
And the Chandler wobble, presumably after the scientist who first noticed it?
I think that would be correct, yeah.
All right. Let's see if we get Jim on the line. Jim's calling us from Spencer, Iowa.
Yes. I heard that in Haiti that the initial earthquake was, the major earthquake was caused by a previous earthquake that may have been the result of too much trash being shoved into the bay, becoming saturated and causing a shelf to snap. Is this something that you know about?
I have not heard that to be the case, and I would be a little bit skeptical of that because the amount of force that's required to trigger an earthquake is extremely substantial, certainly a quake of that magnitude. So,
well, I think it was the original earthquake. It was like 2 weeks earlier there was a small tremor, and this was a storm that had saturated all this trash in the bay, and I think I heard this on BBC, so it's not necessarily just over the bar kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a new one on me. That's all I can say about that.
Okay.
Thanks. And what depth do these earthquakes happen?
Well, these depend. I mean, the Haitian earthquake was, as I recall, about 8 miles deep, and this one in Mexico is about 6 miles deep. And that's actually one reason it was felt so widely is that it was pretty shallow. So if the seismic waves have to travel through a huge amount of earth just to get to the surface, then by the time they reach the surface, they've been slowed down a little bit and
lost a little bit of their power.
Exactly. So shallower earthquakes tend to be felt more readily, and both of these would be considered shallow quakes.
And I know that this is not an exact science to look ahead to see what kind of aftershocks there would be, but after a quake of this magnitude, you can expect substantial aftershocks.
Absolutely.
And for some period of time.
Absolutely. For years, as a matter of fact, you can. And the rule of thumb is you could expect an aftershock sort of one magnitude smaller than your earthquake is extremely likely to happen. So in this case, 6.2 magnitude aftershock would surprise nobody. And then you'd get many more magnitude in sort of the next magnitude down and so on. So you get lots of them, and they're spread out over time. And one thing that's interesting is even though the frequency of these aftershocks will gradually diminish over time, you could still get that big one, that the substantial aftershocks months or even a year later after this quake.
And it would not be seen as a distinct event, but as an aftershock.
It would not be. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Of course, that would matter more to the seismologist than to the people on the ground.
That's indeed the case.
We're talking with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. By the way, we have looked up the Loma Prieta quake was October 1989, and so far we've been unable to detect a China quake in 1989 with anything near 50,000 dead, but we're going to continue to see if we can find that, and if so, we'll bring you up to date on that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Carrie. Carrie with us from Scottsdale.
Hi. I know a lot about the Ring of Fire, and could you please explain what that is?
Besides a really great song by Johnny Cash.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, he appropriated a lovely word. Well, basically, around the Pacific Basin, the whole Pacific Ocean, it's called the Ring of Fire because it is an area of great volcanic activity, essentially. And these volcanoes tend to be around the plate boundaries between the Pacific Plate and all of the other surrounding plates. And so you have a lot of volcanic activity around that ring, hence the Ring of Fire. But you also have a lot of earthquake activity associated with those volcanoes, or in the case of California, the volcanoes are a little bit more inland, but the plate boundaries are where these earthquakes occur. So you have, for example, down in Mexico, as far as I'm aware, there are not huge volcanic activity of volcanoes down there, but you still have the same plate tectonics happening with one part of the Earth's crust grinding against the other, essentially, over time.
And like a ring around the Aleutian Islands, down through Japan and down through Eastern Asia and then all the way around back up through South America, Chile, as we saw, and up through the San Andreas Fault in California.
Right, and Mount St. Helens and so on. So that's absolutely right. That's the ring.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Carrie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to this is Pete. Pete with us from Houston.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Pete.
Hi. I just want to say this question about whether there are an unusual amount of earthquakes. You know, Haiti and Chile have made the news, but it's the case that there's about 17 to 20 magnitude 7 earthquakes in the world every year, and so that means we really ought to expect one every 2 or 3 weeks.
And you know this how, Pete?
Excuse me?
And those are the USGS statistics. That is indeed the case. And a lot of them happen in the ocean, and it is true. We get all these things all the time.
So the notion that this is a swarm is not correct. It's just that people pay attention to earthquakes when they're near California.
They do a lot of damage. That's absolutely
when they
the
kill
case.
People.
That's absolutely the case, that
they're somehow related. The caller before was remembering two earthquakes that were kind of near each other in time, and so he thought that they must be related. He doesn't know about the other 100 earthquakes that occurred during that same time. It's really quite, the largest earthquakes, that is the magnitude 9 earthquakes, they may have some effect on some other earthquakes, but magnitude 6 and 7 earthquakes have a very unlikely chance of making an earthquake happen elsewhere, but they're going to happen anyway because we have dozens of these sorts of earthquakes every year.
That's true. Certainly for the as you say, the sevens are around almost 20 a year on average, and the six magnitudes are 10 times as many, something like that.
Hundreds, but fives and sixes will be hundreds
right.
every year.
That's right. And so just as you say, we notice them when they do damage and when they strike close to home. Absolutely.
Yeah, but people shouldn't get to be so too exercised about the fact that one happened last week, because one happened the week before that too.
That's true. It's just that we've just had this string of damaging and deadly earthquakes, and I think that gets people's attention for sure.
Oh, and we should be worried about the damage, but we shouldn't be worried about there being a connection that's unusual, because tomorrow will be just like yesterday.
Good point.
Thank you very much for the call. Pete, do you study this thing?
Yeah, I'm a professor of geology in the University of Houston.
Oh, okay. So that's how you happen to know all the stuff off the top of your head.
That's right.
And is Houston vulnerable to earthquakes?
No, we're vulnerable to hurricanes, but not earthquakes.
Well, everybody gets their own poison, I guess.
That's right.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Bye.
And Richard Harris, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Oh, by the way, Loma Prieta, October 17th, 1989, 7.1 magnitude. Datong, China, October 19th, 6.1 magnitude. So there was one a couple of days later, so in China. But as we just heard, maybe that's not such a big deal.
A six measurement magnitude earthquake is not that big a deal. So there are hundreds a year of that size, so not too surprising.
Richard Harris with us here in Studio 3A. More on this later today on All Things Considered. Coming up, the Final Fours and the culmination of March Madness. We know, it's April. NPR's Mike Pesca will join us to talk about the Bracket Busters, the Cinderellas, who might cut down the Nets tonight in Indianapolis and tomorrow night in San Antonio, and also about plans to expand the tournament to 96 teams. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.